Okay, hello everybody. We are recording the podcast for our April 13th show because I have a very special appointment that won't let me get into the studio. So when you see this podcast and listen to it, and I get you inflamed enough to send me a question or a comment, don't be upset that I'm not answering you. I will see them eventually, but it's been pre-recorded. It's a brand new show. I don't feel like playing any of my old shows. They're all out there if anybody wants to see them. So we're going to talk about the topic of what happens when someone takes over a country. And I'm going to use two examples that, again, because of my age and the time I grew up and when I was even in the military and stuff, I interacted with some of the parts of these events. And what happens is, when someone takes over a country and decides, as our president, that he inherited a mess, and I'm not trying to bring this back to Donald, but I want you to understand, in history, we've had many people who've taken over countries, and they poo-poo what was happening before, they're going to give you a better this, your sliced bread is going to taste better, everything. Promise the world, and then give them whatever you feel you want to when you get in power. And we don't want to get to where it's too late. And so I picked two countries that I think are great examples that you can all go back and get some more definition on. But we had two leaders that took over in the mid-1900s that stayed around for quite a while. One of them, in fact, only passed away recently. The countries that I'm going to point to so you could see this, we're not going to go back to World War II and pre-World War II. I've already said, please look up Benito Mussolini. He was a great study on how people took over a country and didn't do anything good for it, really. And eventually, his countrymen hung him. Italy isn't as dense a country and as big a population back then. So it was a bit more personal when they all got pissed at him eventually with what happened to them and what they went through because of him. Hitler, Stalin, much bigger communities of people. And actually, each of them had a different way of pointing to the other. Everybody who gets in and wants to take over wants to poo-poo what happened before, wants to say things are a mess. Most of us have been alive long enough, if we've been voting, that we know when Obama came into office, we were in the midst of what's been termed the Great Recession. Nobody wants to think of it as the Great Depression, but it was really ugly. 750,000 people per month were losing jobs when he took over the presidency. Now, if anybody wants to call anything a mess, look at what Obama took over and had to work with. The sad thing to me, and it's not because I voted for him or I like him, every president that's been there, and even the ones I voted for, have done good and bad things. But Obama, who was a fairly thoughtful guy, understood more of international relations. I would like, if anybody wants to play what if, and we'll never know the answer. What if Obama took over a decent economy, which was only a little bit into a recession, not falling off a cliff? Imagine if he had a Congress that worked with him a little more, as our Congress is supposed to do. I don't care whether it's 50-50 Republican or Democratic. That doesn't matter. What we will discuss in a future podcast is how I think we ought to start viewing our senators and our representatives. We don't send them there to make deals so that they bring home a bridge for us. We have our local economies. We want to get our fair share of what comes out of the federal budget. But the real reason is these people represent over 300 million people. In our main government, our national government, and they're there to see that our economy works for all of us. There's no simple answers. Everybody will disagree on things. So I want to just go back and reflect on how economies go and The two economies I'm going to mention are Cuba with Fidel Castro, and then the Philippines with a guy named Ferdinand Marcos. There's tons of books out there. There's lots of information. Now, let me say this. Cuba, because of its relative closeness, now most people know about that if they've heard about the Kennedy missile crisis, the Cuban missile crisis, the Bay of Pigs. Cuba is less than 100 miles off the coast of Florida, basically. So it's right in our neighborhood. Cuba, back in the old days, before Castro, it was more of what, I hate to use beneficent dictator, because there are some people who, although they've been strong leaders and have taken over more total control of their country, depending on the size of their country and the density of the properties they have to control and the time they were around and the ability to get around the country. There are so many variables that hit it. As I said, economics are these natural laws. And as I said, my favorite economist in general, and there are a lot of great ones that we have out there, was Dr. Henry Kaufman. He said, you want to understand economics, get out in the middle of society and view the thousands of variables. Start to understand them. It's not easy to put together a complex formula, no matter how big it is, that'll tell you how everyone's going to flop day to day because they all interact. You've got so many variables and so many people pushing the variables. So when it came to Cuba, Cuba was around at a time when air travel was growing, was bigger. People liked going for a great vacation. And vacation at that point meant flying somewhere, going a little further if you had the money. And Cuba, again, less than 100 miles off the coast, became a resort area. In fact, there was a strong influence from what everybody refers to as the mafia, which, if you think about the mafia even, there's a lot to read there and learn. Forget about The Godfather, where you saw them all fighting with each other. That's no different than in ancient China. You had all the different warlords fighting because each one wanted to take over the territory or be in charge. Cuba was in a more modern era, and you had anywhere before Castro, a couple of million people, under 10 million people on a island, a couple of small islands around it. So it wasn't that big a population or big an area to control. The guy who was there before Castro, he was a bit of a character, a crook, but there was money that came in because illegal money could come in. It wasn't part of the United States. It was easy to get to. So they built hotels and gambling casinos. I've known in my lifetime, which has been considerable at this point, but I have a lot to go yet. I knew a lot of people, professionals and regular people, who went to Cuba before Castro. Went there to vacation, nice hotels, beautiful beaches, Caribbean waters, but also to gamble. Humans like to gamble. It dates way back into our psyche. That's why Vegas has been successful. That's why Monte Carlo, all kinds. Macau in Asia has been a gambling mecca going way back. So gambling is part of the psyche of humans. They like taking a chance, doing things, not just jumping off a building and see if they could survive. And it's an addiction of sorts, gambling. Well, Cuba prospered because of that. It was easy to get people from the East Coast down to Cuba, and even people from California would fly over and then go there, Texas, the rest of it. But Cuba was close enough, so it benefited from money that came in, built the hotels because people would gamble, and the mob, which really controlled the gambling in Cuba together with the government, made a lot of money, period, because they didn't have to hide, to have a bookie behind the door taking numbers. You didn't have Elliot Ness running after them. Anybody who doesn't know who he is, just look it up. Goes back to the movie called The Untouchables and the rest of it, in the heyday of the Depression and gangsters with illegal operations in the United States. So Cuba was kind of ripe because Cuba, when they talk about it, if you look up the statistics, before Castro took over, approximately the late 50s, I think it was 59, Cuba had what was considered a 76% literacy rate. Now, don't mistake this for everybody was college educated. Back in the 50s, if you went to the streets of New York, some of our most popular newspapers were written, and I don't mean this as an insult, you want to sell newspapers. This is pre-internet and computers and the rest of it. It was written for a third or fourth grade reading level. And there's nothing wrong with that. When we discuss things, we don't go into gigantic words that'll confuse people. We want to be understood. So newspapers that sold well, you know, the Post, the Daily News, things like that, they were more literate papers, but they even didn't write at a college level. So when they talk about literacy, a 76% literacy rate, they were talking as compared to other people. My own parents, neither one got to finish public school. They were the oldest child in their family, respectively, and both of them had to go out and work because they were born before the Depression, but growing up in and living through it. So literacy just meant people could generally read and write. So they were one of the best nations in the American hemisphere with a literacy rate. They were the 11th in ratings for phones and doctors, per capita number of doctors. The 11th in the world, I believe, was Cuba before Castro. Now, that's because they did have a good education system. People who had the money and had the means could get well educated. So you're talking about a place, but it was divided. You had these great city Havana, some other ones, but mainly Havana, that was built up. They had a lot of mega hotels, not the gigantic ones you see now. Think of hotels more like what you'd see at South Beach in Miami. That was the era of the hotels, some a little bigger. But as Miami and Miami Beach were building, that's the type of hotel that was being built there. Great service, everything else. So it was good jobs for the people because this was an economy that was being built on tourism and gambling. The big cities were really nice looking and the rest of it. Great places to stay if you're coming down as a foreigner and you're staying there. The rural part of the country, people, the main product in Cuba was sugarcane. Now that may sound, you know, funny to people that that's the product. If you look at a country like Venezuela or Saudi Arabia, forget the politics that are going on. Their main product is oil. And it was enough oil that they have and have had that they could sell it, make enough to run the country on what they needed. Sugar is one of these commodities that's been around historically. And because of the growing of it, farming and the rest of it in the Central American, the tropics technically. Sugar was a major commodity that people wanted and used before everybody was putting how much sugar is on a label, and we all got into understanding it could cause us problems in the long run. It's just like cigarettes. You could smoke. Nobody was going crazy with labeling the packages that you may die if you take another puff. Sugar became a very great commodity, and that was Cuba's thing. They were big on the market with it, and they were selling it to us, the United States. We were so close, transportation wasn't a big deal. Now, when it comes to certain commodities, when you study economics, sugar has a certain amount of density. So to ship it as bulk and its weight, transportation adds a lot of cost, so you could get a better price with less cost of shipping, transportation, if you could ship from Cuba to the United States rather than Cuba over to Europe. So products make a difference. Salt, same thing. Salt dates back that if you look way before America was even a dream to anybody. In the northern parts of Africa and the Middle East, salt was the commodity. Who heard of refrigeration? Nobody. They would use salt to pack things and cure it and keep it from getting bad. Salt was like gold back in the old days. So Cuba had this commodity called sugar. They were doing well selling it to the U.S. Gambling and vacationing started to build up. But in the rural areas, the people would be spending only a couple of months out of the year really cutting the sugar cane and the rest. So they really didn't have a good full-time job throughout the year. So you had a population in a lot of the country that was a little resentful because they were going day to day just trying to survive. At the same time, Cuba, in deference to the Philippines, the background, it was a mixed culture of Spanish, some local Indians that dated back thousands of years, and then other people that commingled. But like a lot of countries, they had this distinction, as in a lot of the Caribbean, between the color that you were. Castro, he was trained as a lawyer. He was an educated guy, but he was considered a term that a lot of people have heard, a mulatto. There are some specifics. It's often thought of as a mixed black and white person, but it's sometimes anybody who falls in the middle category of colors or the lighter color schemes. You don't appear to be white. You have enough color that they think you've got a mix in you. He was actually not allowed in the high-class clubs in Havana, Cuba, because of him being considered a mulatto. So when he took over, of course, he was not too happy about these color distinctions. The people were happier because he appeared to be one of them. When he took over Cuba, he was actually something you don't see in a lot of the articles that are out there on the internet. He actually trained with us. Some of our agencies helped train him because we knew there was a possibility of a revolution. And I hate to say it, I believe our agencies were hedging bets and working both sides of the road. You know, working with the Cuban government, but they figured the mob keeps them in line enough and we'll work with this other guy so if a revolution happens, we're not caught off guard. Our intelligence agencies are out there to see what's going on in the world and tell us, good or bad, so that we can plan so we are not surprised. Pearl Harbor was a surprise. Go back and read. It wasn't just the attack you heard. Believe it or not, there were things after World War I that said powers couldn't build certain war machines. A lot of it was done in secret. So we were caught off guard with it. We didn't have satellites giving us images and stuff. So everything's got to be put back in its period so you understand it a little better, what you could and couldn't do. So Cuba, when Castro came down, he was the great hero and he took over. We thought he was going to be a pal of the U.S. and the rest of it. They were dead wrong. After he took over, he showed his true thing. He decided to lean more toward Marx and Lenin. Khrushchev was basically the head of the Soviet Union back then. And Khrushchev didn't mind because we were the sworn enemy of the Soviet Union, not Russia, that big Soviet Union before the Eastern Bloc and the Berlin Wall fell and all that good stuff. So Khrushchev was out there trying to dole out things and get a foothold in different areas for his own strategy for Russia. Again, it is the Soviet Union, but Russia is the key. They're the people who ran the place. So Castro started giving his sugar to Russia if they gave him enough money to run his economy. For an educated, smart man, he didn't understand economics that well. His country started running short of things, started running short of money and stuff. He didn't know how to charge Russia for it. And I hate to say this, Russia was never a rich economy, especially back then. The thing that helped them fall apart, even when the curtain fell and the rest of it was, they did such a screwy job of misunderstanding how to run an economy because they wanted nobody to have a stranglehold within the country. The way they did things defied logic of good process and good economic understanding. So Castro takes over, and then he lets his colors show out, and he says he's going to, you know, trade with Russia and the rest of this. And actually, he was having a choice. China was out there. They weren't open to us yet, our hemisphere, but they didn't have any money back then. So till they opened up their economy, as they did years ago, and started acting like a capitalist country and making all the money they did because of the greed of the companies and the CEOs who moved production over to China so they could make more money out of their market in America. So don't always listen to these countries just started making products, sending it here, and we have a balance of trade. No, that is bullshit. Companies were now able to, with better transportation, big carrier boats, better planes, start to move things offshore. If you study the history of the furniture industry, in New York City, we manufactured a lot of furniture 150, 200 years ago. When New York City built up and the real estate became expensive, that shifted into the Carolinas, where they had more room, more people at a better rate. And then eventually, we're buying furniture for us in America. It wasn't a big deal if it was made in New York or North Carolina or South Carolina or anywhere like that. It was still within our country. Our people were working. The money was here, the taxes in the price got into our treasury. When they started to offshore it, that's when we started having the problem, because we were getting things, but we weren't getting the bargain rate of that thing. The corporations were making more money, period. So Castro starts running this thing, and he's very anti-American, the rest of it. He invites the Russians in to help him. He needed somebody. China didn't have the money to help him at that point. So Khrushchev was careful with what he did because, and this is opinion, nobody asked Khrushchev, he's dead. He may have made some statements, but Khrushchev was afraid to really have that nuclear war with us. He was smart enough to know that he could maybe kill us, but we'd be wiping them out also. So again, putting it in perspective, Khrushchev helped. He wanted to have this foothold. Imagine, Khrushchev was worried about NATO. NATO, our buddies, who we helped and won World War II with in the European theater. The importance of NATO, when the Soviet Union at the end of the war tried to take the countries it had and we tried to limit how much they took, the Soviet Union, mainly Russia, knew that they had our armaments in some of these countries right near their border. You know, here's your wall, here's a free country, here's part of the Soviet Union. Would you want weapons right on your border? So the Soviet Union, under Nikita Khrushchev, loved working with Castro because they said, hey, now we can put some weapons and have bases right off of America. So that when we tell them we don't like your NATO bases right near our border. So I'm telling you, this was the major significance of why Khrushchev wanted to have this foothold in our hemisphere. And then with indoctrination and pushing, you know, if you want our help is what Castro was learning from them. If you're going to be a Marxist, Leninist, you know, communist, they wanted to see him spread the word into the Latin American countries because he looks like and sounds like them. He also, for them, trained people from Africa. He had them come into Cuba for training so that he'd start some of the insurgency. So you have to understand, there are people who've been in charge of certain countries that are happy to fund training of people to start insurgency in any country. We have to learn to work better as humans so that we don't let this crap continue, because nobody wins when it happens. And we all pay for it, and with lives, friends that I've known that are no longer around, and the rest. So Cuba was interesting. There was this big racial divide. There was this poorer group in the suburban areas, in the rural areas. So Castro did do some nice stuff. He did make basic education better for everybody, because in the rural areas, they got very few years of education. He brought some medical help, because remember I told you, Cuba, when he took over, was the 11th out of, again, the world, 11th for doctors per capita. We have over 200 countries in this world. So they had a lot of trained doctors considering the size of their population, again, in the few millions. I believe now Cuba is maybe 10, 11 million people. So again, single island, generally speaking, smaller population, easier to control and work with. Took over in 59, changed everything, put martial law in, no more term limits. He started the youth being trained. He used, like most, again, if we call them dictators or strong leaders, whichever you want, they use something that's called a cult of personality. If you go to any of these countries that have more autocratic governments, you will see statues of their current great leader. You will see big pictures of their current leader hanging all over buildings. Okay? They have ceremonies to celebrate that that's our leader. They want you to feel that that's your father. He is there for you. He makes everything good for us. So that's called a cult of personality. So Castro was pretty good when he took over and the rest of it. But even one of his main revolutionaries, beside him and his brother, was Che Guevara. He was more actually one of the more strategic and group leaders in the fighting that went on. Che was pretty well known. When you look him up, Che Guevara, he was a good insurgent. He understood how to wage a campaign. He got to a point where he actually left because he was disagreeing with what Cuba was turning into. So again, you had an economy that was doing well. It wasn't sharing with all their people. You had an autocratic leader who just declared martial law, forget term limits. And by the way, I believe Castro finally passed away in 2014. His brother, Raul Castro, runs the country. They never really plan. If you're a good leader and you care about your people, I have to tell you this. You plan for succession. If you run a corporation, if you run a business, your business is going to go nowhere if none of your children want to run it. If you don't train somebody to take it over, God forbid you die. If you built that business, you want your business to remain. So that's what a country is like when it gets taken over by an autocrat. Castro never really groomed anyone to be the takeover leader. To a certain extent, that's great, since he lived very long. We didn't worry. If he dies, okay, there'll be a little bit of a jostling around. That's why Obama tried to open up relations also, to the point where they want to grow their economy a little more. So you had someone who took over, very autocratic, changed the way he gave people some good stuff. He opened up some more medical clinics and the rest of it. Nothing is all bad about any leader, unless they're really horrible and just keep shooting people until you live in your cave and we're not going to give you anything. There are many of those around. That was Castro. The Philippines was a different story. The Philippines is an area that it's not one big island like Cuba, which is not a big island, but that's where your population was. The Philippines is over 1,100 islands, the last time I looked it up. And a lot of them are small and uninhabited, but a lot of them are decent size. So you've got population centers throughout this whole area on these different islands. And you had, even back in the 50s, almost 10 times the population of Cuba in the Philippines. Now, if you live in the tip of Long Island and it's the the mid-30s and somebody in Washington says something, you're going to say, I don't give a shit what they say. They're far away from me. They can't even hear me. They can't even get to me. Humans relate to proximity. So in the Philippines, it was a little bit different. World War II, because it involves basically the whole world different ways, and because the Japanese, what a lot of people don't understand, the people in Japan are very industrious people. Even though they owed allegiance to an emperor before World War II. They needed resources. They are not a resource-rich island, even with their smaller islands. So they went out to conquer, to get resources. That's why they went into China to take things over. So when they moved in, they went into Singapore and other places. And by the way, if you want to look up beneficent dictators, look up President Lee in Singapore. I think he's still alive or may have recently died. He was, again, a strong leader, but he grew a good democratic country where he was seriously in charge, did some nasty things with his people, but did a lot of good. Singapore, again, being a city state, one area, easier to control. Big companies wanted to get in there. It's well located for commerce and everything else. So look up President Lee in Singapore, another interesting one to study. But actually a nicer guy in how he treated his own people than a lot of these other autocratic leaders. So now the Philippines, you had the Marcos family kind of in the background before Ferdinand Marcos took over in the mid-60s. And the Philippines were a big part of the troops that helped us fight the battle in World War II from the Asian theater, especially. So the Japanese had taken over the Philippines for resources. So they kicked the Americans out, but the Philippine people were very disgruntled with them. They were very brutal wherever they took over. Again, this was an emperor leading a country, so all of his people were just following orders. It wasn't a free society that took over their country. So with the Marcos, interestingly enough, in a more modern world, I got to travel, because I traveled to a lot of different parts of the world during my corporate days. So beside my research and my reading and people I met and my natural curiosity, I was in the Philippines. The company I worked for that I've mentioned before that built nuclear power plants legitimately in other countries as allowed. The Philippines never had a great power system. It was very fragmented and everything else. So at one point, they actually decided they were going to build a nuclear power plant. I believe it was sold to them through Westinghouse in the old days, because some of our big companies were the main suppliers when nobody else was building these things. That's also kind of going away. That's another whole story to understand. But my company was actually consultants to the Philippine government. So we were their guy, like, watching the contractor who's building it, because we had the knowledge to tell them if they're getting what they're paying for. Western company overlooking a Western company that's delivering a nuclear plant. The plant was at an area called Bigac in the Philippines. It's, again, one of these bays. When you have a nuclear plant, one of the major things you need with the kind of nuclear power we've used since the inception of nuclear power, you need a lot of water. So you'll actually see what they call these big impoundments of water where you find a nuclear plant, because they need water. They don't want to wait that there's going to be a drought or there's going to be too many waves. You need the water as part of controlling the temperature in your plants. And the Fukushima that happened in Japan, that was not one of the plants we designed and built. That's when Japan was already had progressed and been trying to compete with us for selling nuclear plants. I believe Fukushima was mainly their design, their build. And from everything I heard, from the engineers and scientists I work with, I hate to say this, I think they took shortcuts in how they built their storage pond for their nuclear waste. That's why they were cracking and having problems and a whole bunch of other things. You got to deal with the whole system properly. Anyway, so in the Philippines, we had a lot of Americans, Douglas MacArthur, his family owned big plantations in the Philippines. Wealthy Americans were around the world and owned things and were landowners, plantation owners. So when he left the Philippines, when the Japanese kicked us out and the rest, and he said, I'll be back. This was a man who was one of our top generals, who was from a very well-to-do family that was going back into the Philippines to to free up the land that used to be his family's. I'm not saying he didn't have a good purpose for going back for us, but this was a man who was going back to reopen a country that he grew up in as an American citizen. So the Philippines was different. They had 10 times the population easily in those 1,100 islands that they had in Cuba. The Philippines, and again, firsthand, I've been in the Philippines because of the people we had stationed there and the questions they had and the reports we had to file with the government, and we're doing business in a foreign jurisdiction. It was part of my job to make sure we did business right, worked within the laws, filed what was needed, that our people were comfortable, because when you assign Americans or anybody into a country that's not their original country, you have to take care of them differently. They're out of their own element. You're sending them there for technical reasons, but you want to make sure that they're comfortable with what's going on, that they're getting what they want. And I can tell you, because of my interaction with people, I discovered that there were people out there like snake oil salesmen who wanted to tell these people that while they were out of the country in these places, they didn't have to pay taxes, they didn't have to do this, they didn't have to do that. So when you take educated, technical people and put them in a foreign country, they may be living in a great environment, they may be doing their job, they may be earning extra money, which is part of what they get out of the assignment, but they're hearing from people that they can, hey, just say, I'm exempt from this or that. Everybody likes the idea that if I just paint myself purple, I'm exempt from taxes. And there are some people who might believe it if you tell it to them. So it was my job to, among other things, go out there and talk to our people and straighten them out, because if they would start filing things wrong, they would start yelling when they were getting investigated by Internal Revenue. We would get investigated because didn't we teach these people right? And even if we did, we don't control their personal return. So I had to go out there and help them, because if they didn't understand what was happening, we'd end up spending more money fighting with the local government, our government, and everything else. So in the Philippines, you had more of a, again, people in the modern era, mid-19th century up, they like using the term president or prime minister. As I said on my prior podcast, do not let words fool you, okay? I've learned that we all use words differently. We all understand them differently. The universal language that helped me doing deals anywhere in the world was mathematics. It's not a science. To me, mathematics is a language. 2 + 2 is going to be 4 in mathematics. You can get into calculus. It's the same all over the planet. Different languages use it, but it's still math. So math is an expressional type of science that'll tell you the relationship between things. So I found out that when I did a contract or work with people in other countries, I put what I like to refer to, it's an old nuclear age term, fail-safe, meaning if nothing else worked, break the hammer, this'll stop the fire maybe. I would put a clause in contracts in other countries, no matter how I understood their law, that would say, we've agreed that you're going to give us this, we're going to do that, and we're going to leave with X. Never had a problem. They didn't have to love me or not. There was a mathematical formula built into that thing. So when it came to the Philippines, and we're advisors to that government and interacting with them and have people living there, I would go there to work with our people to make sure that I answered their questions. So we didn't have a mini revolution because they didn't know what was happening to them under the tax laws there or here. By the way, at the beginning, I said that I'm recording this. So if any of you have questions, don't go hitting your thing and sending me. We will eventually see them. Don't think I'm disregarding you if I'm not answering you, because this is the first podcast that I'm pre-recording, because I can't be in the studio on April 13th, that Saturday morning. But I wanted to give you a fresh podcast. I always have topics to work on. So just be my guest, as I said, AE, the equal sign, MC squared, AE, the word equals, MCSQ. You've got my Gmail. It's out there. Go to the Culture Radio, the way you dial into this. You'll see it on my site. There are different ways of contacting. And we'll get back to you, okay? It's not that I don't want to answer your questions. I wanted to give you a fresh perspective. So what I'm trying to get to, in these countries, due to conditions at a given time, Ferdinand Marcos sequestered billions of dollars outside the country. He ended up going to Hawaii for a while because our country, we were very friendly with the Philippines. We have still one of our biggest naval bases in that part of the world. I believe it's called Subic Bay. So strategically, it makes sense for us to keep good relations. We now have a guy who's a bit more dictatorial, Duterte, if I'm not mispronouncing his name. Again, someone our president likes, because our president likes people who seem to take charge. So we have people, what the Philippines happened, and I watched it because I was there. They educated people. The Philippines really believe in education. And tons of Filipinos went to universities, if not in their country, outside if they had the money. But they became doctors and lawyers, CPAs, nurses, professionals. This was a way out of the general poverty in a country that's growing, because in the big cities you had some places and wealthy old families, but you generally had a population that was still living kind of rural. So once they got educated, Marcos was brilliant. He would take these educated people and he'd ship them to other countries. When we thought we had these great big accounting firms in America, believe me, I was in the Far East and other places in the world. One of the biggest accounting firms on the planet was originally started by the Filipinos. And it was all over Asia, and they did clients here, but they were big and they were respected. They had law firms, but a lot of them came here. There was a point when Ronald Reagan was president and he was starting this thing that, well, we have too many people coming in here. And he started the I-9 to identify whether people are in here legally, illegally, or whatever. He didn't understand. He could have asked his advisors and listened to them. He didn't understand that we had lots of Filipino nurses that the majority of hospitals in this country were counting on. I've had great Filipino friends. I've had people on my staff in my corporate days that were Filipinos, wonderful people. They enjoy life, they get educated, and they want to live like anybody else. But when they come out and they live here, like anybody else who goes to another country and sees a better life, they don't want everybody to believe that they forgot about their family back in the home country. So what would happen is all these people who had great jobs and were well-educated were sending money back to the Philippines to their family. The way Marcos had the Philippines set up, no money could get into these families without passing through the Bank of the Philippines. And it was a toll charge. So he didn't mind. He put the people who were educated and might be more revolutionary, let them be out of the country. And I can also tell you, most of the entertainers in the Far East and the Asian areas were Filipinos. They're very artistic people. They were already used to, you know, entertaining, music and the rest of it. It was part of their culture. So they became entertainers throughout the Far East. That was another group that went out. So basically what he had left, the majority of the Filipinos that weren't out there earning big money because they were educated and had these other skills, and I saw this firsthand, believe me. What happened, and there's nothing wrong with it. This is a world that's growing. He would take this big toll charge. The families would get money, and the people would come visit now and then. But they weren't going to move back because they could live better here, earn more money here, and do more for their family in their home country. And any of us would look at it this way. If we could get educated and not be able to make the money in our home country that we could make moving somewhere else. But when you manage that so it doesn't blow up in your face, So what Marcos did, for example, is a big city, Manila, and I was in a number of the big cities, but Manila being the capital, he'd have people that he had taking care of the streets. They'd be either wearing a skirt if they were women or black pants, either sex, and they'd be wearing a white blouse, and they had a big sombrero for the heat, for the sun, because they were going to be working outside all day. He'd give them a broom, and I saw this firsthand. I'm not making any of this up. These people were paid enough money so they could work hard and go buy food and feed their family. He didn't keep them impoverished, per se. But imagine if you put all these people out there working about 10 hours in the hot sun on your major streets, and you give them a broom handle, and the bottom is not your normal broom with all these 300 little pieces of stuff woven together so you could push your dirt nicely. They had little twigs that were tied around the end of it. As you're trying to push dirt or dust, it's running in between it. I'm not joking. I saw this in their capital. Hopefully it's changed at this point. I saw when I went into the outskirts, into some of the back areas, because our plant was not in the capital, it was far away from it. What they did was, if you had a local bridge that was knocked down. Now remember, in the Far East and the Philippines, they get these cyclones, which are brutal. They're even stronger than the hurricanes we get here. So between cyclones and tornadoes, you'd have some of these bridges across these little creeks and rivers that were built, that were blown apart. Now, they had money coming in and stuff, and they're building a nuclear power plant. Do you think they'd get an earth-moving equipment and rebuild that bridge? No. They hired people, regular workers, to go out there, clean up the mess, and rebuild that little bridge by hand. And it was the same in a lot of places. What Marcos was doing was giving them enough of a wage to afford food, working them long enough during the day so they'd be tired. You don't have enough people that are up for starting a revolution. And again, he exported his educated people. There were a lot of agencies that placed these doctors and lawyers and accountants and nurses all over the world. And they were good. We all benefited from it. But he didn't need these heavy-thinking people back in his country. So he was a great manipulator when it came down to it. He also, at certain points, changed their constitution so that nobody could push him out or anything else. So this is what happened when you get an autocrat. I hate to say it. Every time I see Trump sign another, make his pretty signature on another executive order, he complained when he was campaigning that Obama used too many executive orders. He's far exceeded it in his first 2 years. He's decided that he doesn't have to live by your rules. He's going to see how far he can push things. Remember, we have a rule here that no man is above the law or woman. He's a guy who feels, well, yeah, I'm going to push it and see if they challenge me. So he puts these out. To him, they're more like edicts. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to take money that's already in a budget that I don't control and try and get it under my control. He has a Congress that's been complicit. Look at the Senate. People talk about quid pro quo. It isn't always that somebody rips up your ticket and you pay them $50. That's quid pro quo. On a bigger scale, people don't always think about how it happens. Trump is giving the current Republican Party, and there's nothing wrong with being a Republican, but I've lived a long time. I've been in Washington the majority of my life when I was working in corporate America. Republicans, like Democrats, were doing their job. They'd get together and work on things. Not while he's president. They just want all those nominees so they can put all these judges out there, so they're ultra-conservative. That's why you see Americans, because in this day and age, they're realizing that we've been duped. I don't care if you're talking Democrat or Republican. We know a little more. What we have to do is learn to work together. And yes, hit the streets. Tell these guys that, you know what, don't worry about the NRA not reelecting you. We won't reelect you. We'll put in someone who's never been in government. So while they're getting used to it, we'll think about who we're going to put in the next time round. We've got to get rid of people who decide that they're going to do what they want. We got a president who brings his entourage down Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago is a hotel. He may own it, but he's supposed to divorce himself from his operations. He's bringing guests. It's almost $1 million a weekend that he's putting in his company for himself and the Secret Service and everybody else who comes there, and the additional membership fees, and he charges for renting the golf carts. We give him a place called Camp David, which is secured for any president. I'm not saying he can't go on a vacation when he wants to, but he keeps dragging people to places where he's making money while we're talking about a minimum wage. Think about it, folks. The quid pro quo is the Republicans currently in the Senate are not doing their job of oversight because they're a separate co-equal branch of government. They're supposed to be telling this president, we want to see why you're doing this. We don't want you to start a war. We don't want you to put your son-in-law in top clearance so he could take nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia to sell them. We don't allow that to happen. They're not stopping him. So, you know, they don't have to buy the weapon. They have to buy the plans. And if this guy gets to take a copy of the plans and take it over there. So quid pro quo could be as simple as Donald is doing what he wants and they're allowing it to happen. Our Senate not representing us. We put them there. They are there to monitor any president who's in office, no matter whether they're a Republican, Democrat, independent, doesn't matter. Don't get brushed aside by, this is a socialist, this is a progressive. They're Americans, they have a job to do, they're not doing it. This is how you get authoritarian governments or dictatorships. This is how you give up your freedom. It is our country. It's up to us to keep it our country. So I urge you to go look at the Philippines. I urge you to go look at Cuba. There are tons of stories and books. There were atrocities committed by both of these guys. Atrocities are committed all over the world. When I talk to people, they'll say, well, why are you worried about him doing it? They did it. When I was growing up, one of the basic things I got slapped for 1,000,000 times was two wrongs don't make a right. Just because little Joey down the block did something didn't mean I'm excused when I do it. No, I was taught that that's not right. You don't do it. Forget what little Joey did. So we got to get back to basics, people. That's why on my table, when I do my podcast in the studio, I put that little sign up there that says MIH, make it happen. It's up to us to make it happen. All of this was to pick out two countries that were different in size, background, culture, but it's the same. It's the same. These countries will be free. We can stop them by, you know what? Buying things that only come from here. Every dollar China is spending, taking over parts of the world, came out of our pockets. So, I think I've done enough for an hour podcast. It may run over a drop, but any questions, please send them in. I hope this gave you a fresh podcast for Saturday, April 13th. I will see you the Saturday after. So thank you for listening. Again, I'm looking to make more of an opening for you to share these things with other people. We're all Americans. We all own the country. Period. Thank you and have a great week.